This is the Round Table Podcast, episode 12.
Hi, everybody. I'm Brian Humphrey.
And I'm Dave Robison.
And you're listening to the Roundtable Podcast.
On the Roundtable Podcast, Brian and I invite writers to come onto the show and pitch their story ideas to us and our esteemed guest host.
And then we dig into it, talking about what works, what doesn't, kick around some ideas, and try to fine-tune it into a solid and writable story, what Dave likes to call...
literary gold. And am I the only one that likes to call that, Brian?
No, I love calling it that. I just like how you say it. It makes me shiver.
Okay, shiver. See, now that's kind of creeping me out. but thanks for that. You're not in Greeley, Colorado right now, are you?
I am not. This is my first attempt at making my little studio portable. I'm actually in the basement of my brother-in-law's because it's my niece's birthday today, her first birthday.
Oh, and she has no clue what's going on, does she?
No, she doesn't. But her parents would have been pissed if I had missed it, so.
Well, and you're a good man. See, look at how you honor your obligations to us and to your family. You are a shining example to us all, sir. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And it is not only my niece's birthday, is it?
No. But actually, it's my wife's birth week this week. We don't do birthdays here in the Robison household because there's entirely too much awesomeness involved with the whole celebration of birth thing. So it's kind of like Hanukkah meets birthday. So every day we kind of just roll out a card and a present for a week, and then there's food and there's, you know, wishing people happy birthday for like a week, and it's awesome.
That's all. I may have to adopt your tradition because Allie's 30th birthday is coming up later in May. So,
Dude, that totally warrants a birth week.
Yeah. I think so, too. Yeah, definitely.
Yep, celebrate that. And speaking of celebrating, Brian, I'm actually thinking of changing the name of the podcast to the Roundtable Podcast International.
Totally. This is number two, right?
This is. We had Alistair Stewart on a few weeks back. And now, dear friends and listeners, it is my distinct pleasure to introduce to you the evil genius behind the Hub Fiction e-zine, the chair of the British Fantasy Society, and the editor of Angry Robot Books. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the show, Mr. Lee Harris. Lee, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy evening and joining us on the roundtable, sir.
Well, good evening, or good morning, or good afternoon. Time zones confuse me, but hello.
Oh, God, me too. Ask anybody. Lee, I wanted to ask just one point of clarification. I know you are a editor for Angry Robot Books, and certainly there's more than one, but are you like... The big enchilada editor at Angry Robot?
I'm the only person at Angry Robot, the imprint, with the job title editor. There are two of us that edit for Angry Robot, myself and my very esteemed colleague, who also happens to be my boss and the publishing director of Angry Robot, Mark Gascoigne. But we recently took on two new editors, Amanda Rutter, who's going to be editing our YA range, which launches in September. That's Strange Chemistry. And Emlyn Rees, who's just come on very, very recently, looking after our forthcoming crime imprint, which starts publishing in the spring of next year.
Exhibit A, right?
Exhibit A, exactly right, yes.
Awesome. Now, is that because Angry Robots is... awesome and growing and burgeoning into a dark god of spec fiction?
Well, you know, we like to keep ourselves busy. And I'm always interested to hear all the horror stories about how publishing is shrinking. And for us, it's exactly the opposite. We're a very small imprint. 2.5 years ago, there was literally just Mark Gascoigne and myself. And now there are, I think, seven of us. So we're expanding all the time, and it's nice to have that illusion, at least, of job security.
Job security and success and having an impact on the world.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. But, you know, it's huge amounts of fun. You know, people know who we are these days, which is always very nice. People seem to like the things that we're doing. And it's, you know, I'm just having so much fun with it. It's the best job in the world. Well, second best job in the world.
And what are you looking at on the near horizon? Is there anything going on in either your life, Lee, or with Angry Robots or Hub Fiction or anything along those lines that our listeners should be aware about?
Well, I was listening to your conversation with Alistair this morning as I was getting used to the Roundtable podcast. I listened to a few, and Al's was the last one that I listened to. And I was thrilled to learn that Hub is going to be coming back in June.
you didn't know this.
we keep discussing it, but now Al's put a date on it. There's no way that we can back off from that. So hooray for even more deadlines. British Fantasy Society, of course, we just announced all of the juries for some of the other awards that we're presenting. It's quite a big awards ceremony. We're really looking forward to that. Everything going to be presented at FantasyCon in Brighton in September. And just loads and loads of stuff going on. I'm sure we'll get a chance to have a chat about some of them later.
Excellent. Excellent. Now help me as a neophyte and novice to the publishing jargon. What is a jury for a competition?
It's a small group of well-read individuals who look at, certainly with the British Fantasy Awards, they're looking at the shortlisted books, television programs, films, magazines, what have you, and deciding which is the best of the year. Up until last year's award ceremony, everything was voted on purely by the members. We had a change of policy with the British Fantasy Awards, and that change kicks in with this year's awards. The members choose the long list from which the short list is derived. So the most popular titles then go to a 5-person jury who read everything, watch everything, listen to everything, and decide which are the best of the bunch in their respective categories. So it's a bit of a mixture. Some awards are purely voted on by members, things like the Hugos, of course. Some awards are purely voted on by juries, the Arthur C. Clarke being probably one of the best known in the sci-fi world. Ours mixes the two, so it's an interesting time. Looking forward to seeing how that works.
Oh, yeah, and what a fabulous job to be a member of one of those juries.
Oh, absolutely.
What a delight. I've been following you on Twitter, Lee, and Angry Robots, and I've seen you guys, as you know, stalking you like the dark stalker that I am. And I've noticed you guys have been doing a lot of cons recently, and I just wanted to check and see what cons are you looking at in the near future?
It's a bit of a quiet time at the moment, certainly in the UK for cons. The next one that we'll be looking at will be Edge, which is a one-day convention in Derby. After that, I'll be coming across to Chicago for SheCon,
World
Science Fiction Convention, yeah. Which is always great fun, and extremely hard work, of course. I have to say that just in case the people who pay my salary are listening.
Oh, God, yes, arduous, Herculean in effort, absolutely.
It's amazing. I barely get a chance to sleep. It's such hard work.
Fun at all.
None at all.
Just work.
And then we have FantasyCon in September, followed by a couple of other smaller conventions in the UK. In October, I think we have BristolCon. And that's it for this year, I think. I think my colleague Mark might be popping over for World Fantasy.
Okay.
At some point as well. He won the World Fantasy Award last year for professional award. The work he'd done with Angry Robot, which is fabulous.
Well, it sounds like you've got a busy schedule ahead of you, and many opportunities for folks to connect with you at least once con season ramps up again. I know there's going to be a veritable horde of geeks, nerds, and fans at WorldCon, at ShyCon. That's gonna be a blast. Why don't we, speaking of blasts, pause briefly at this point. Note the graceful segue. And we'll do a quick promotion for another exceptional podcast. When we come back, we'll welcome our guest writer to the show and do some story workshopping. Sound good?
Sounds good to me.
Let's do it to it.
Excellent. Let's do that. We'll be right back, folks.
What are you doing for Memorial Day weekend this year?
I've got the best working vacation planned ever.
I'll be sitting on a panel talking about social media promotion.
I am hanging out with my friends from all over the country and even across the globe.
I'm hitting up several of the writing panels, anything that involves superpowers, but also that gritty sci-fi thriller vibe.
I am going to be hanging out with the largest collection of podcasters in America.
I'm probably going to kill someone.
Sigler! No! Bad author! Bad!
There will be at least one writing morning at the nearby Panera. I hear it's where all of the cool folks go for coffee.
I am spreading myself far too thin and going on both a podcasting track and the literary track.
So, where am I spending this amazing weekend?
At Balticon.
I'm going to 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 Balticon. Shouldn't you be going too? That's Balticon, the Maryland Regional Science Fiction and Fantasy Convention, held Memorial Day weekend each year. For more information, go to balticon.org.
Okay, and we are back. And now is the point where we get into the meat and potatoes, the sweet delight that is the Roundtable Podcast, where we actually sit down and start workshopping some stories. And Brian, this is a pleasure for me on many levels, because our guest writer is not only a compatriot of the Mythic Scribes online community that I speak of so often. Mm-hmm. But also a continuation of our ongoing effort to expand the roster of our guest writers, to not just include writers who are early in the stages of their careers or just starting out writing fantasy or sci-fi or spec fic, but our guest writer this time around is a published author. You can look for By Darkness Revealed out on Amazon, which I have read and enjoyed enormously, a fabulous urban fantasy tale. Also, The Font of Forgiveness, his work is included in the 12 Worlds anthology, and he has two shorter pieces of fiction that are hanging out there, hopefully snapped up at some point, By a Whisker and Jewels in the Night. So we are most pleased to welcome to the Skype line Mr. Kevin McLaughlin. Kevin, thanks for stepping up and offering a story, man.
Dave, glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, one thing I didn't mention, Kevin, is that you are... an enormous advocate of the self-publishing and the indie publishing and the e-publishing side of the business. Is that correct?
It is. I'm an advocate of anything that gives writers more options and ability to enhance and move forward their careers.
And Kevin does an amazing job of that out at his website, which, Kevin, help us out with that. What's the URL?
KevinOMcLaughlin.com.
And if McLaughlin is causing you fits, we'll include a link in the liner notes and make sure that's that it's great. Easy to get to Kevin's site. Kevin does weekly updates of stats from the E-Trade, commentary, insights, gathers together the news of the industry, and really distills it down in a very effective way. Kevin, what do you do? Where are you at right now? And how did you get into writing?
Oh, let's see. Probably... going to do the last question first, I think. How did I get into writing? My mom was writing. She never actually published anything professionally, but she wrote a lot of fan fiction. She wrote a couple of books she wanted to publish professionally. And when I was 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, I would go to sleep listening to my mother playing soundtracks downstairs and tack, 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 tacking on the keyboard.
Ah.
When I was 7, she loaned me her manual typewriter. She actually gave it to me later. From college, and I typed up my first short story, entered it into a first through sixth grade competition, and won second place.
Oh, and you were hooked.
So I was hooked. And I've pretty much been writing in one form or another ever since.
Outstanding. Outstanding. So shall we jeter gracefully off into the land of story pitching at this point?
Sure.
Excellent. Sure. So at this point, 5 to 8 minutes to you, Master McLaughlin. Give us whatever you can on the story idea that you have. We will not interrupt. The mic, sir, is yours.
All right. This is a brand new story, brainstormed only, nothing written. And something about the stories that I write, I tend to write something, when I tend to come up with a new story idea, I tend to try and push something that's going to challenge me. I try and do something a little different from what I've done before. I try to do something a little new. This is one of those. It's a science fiction story with either a romantic undertone or a romance story, which is also set in a science fiction setting. Not sure which yet. We'll have to see once it's written. The story opens with a meteorite striking Earth, bringing with it some sort of virus from outer space. People on Earth realize that it's a problem, realize that the meteorite's infected, immediately quarantine it, and ship it off to a moon base, which is small base, couple dozen people living there, near future storyline here. And along with the meteorite, they ship one of the best xenobiologists in the world. And his daughter, who is a recent master's grad, hasn't done her PhD and whatever, but he's going up there as her assistant. He's insisted. She's going up there as his assistant, rather. And they go up. He manages to synthesize what he thinks is a possible vaccine for the virus. Meanwhile, on Earth, they found that they haven't quarantined it as well as they thought. The virus is breaking out, and it's starting to spread. So he takes what he's got, goes back down to Earth with it, in the hopes of being able to mass produce a vaccine, because he doesn't have the facilities to mass produce it up on the moon. They moved it up there to do the research, the R&D, but keep it away from the Earth, hopefully, but it's kind of past that point at this point. She's left behind, and this is where the romantic elements of the story begin coming together. She immediately gets into something of an adversarial relationship with the guy who's managing the lunar base. They don't hit it off at all. They're at odds immediately. And there's an impression, he has the impression that she's simply there because her daddy was really good at what he did, and so she's getting special favors. She's actually quite good at what she does, and she continues her father's research after he leaves to go back to the planet. But they're continuously butting heads. Meanwhile, things are getting worse back on Earth, and the virus is spreading. It has a high mortality rate. It's extremely virulent. And as things are getting worse, a ship lifts off from Earth carrying a whole bunch of passengers and starts heading toward the moon in hopes of, because there's the rumor that there's a vaccine out there or maybe it's safe out there. They're trying to get away and get to some place where they think they can get treated, get cured. The moon says, "Don't you dare come near us." And there's a standoff with the ship ending up in orbit around the moon and the base refusing to let them land, and the people wanting to land. The people on board the ship who are sick end up taking over the ship and are threatening to crash the ship down to try and land there anyway to do something rash. She offers to go up to the ship with her version of the vaccine, which seems to be working, and is denied. She ends up going up anyway, helps the people on the ship recover the ship, helps to treat some of the people on the ship, and eventually her vaccine is proven to be working and effective, and they bring the people down to a lunar base. During the play-by-play, while she's up on the ship and the potential romantic interest is down on the lunar base, is when they end up connecting long distance, even though they've had problems before. Her being in danger helps to make him aware of how much he cares about her, and her being his support of her after she goes and breaks the rules and goes out there and does her thing helps her grow, create an attachment with him. And that's pretty much the story idea as it stands. They are reunited at the end, and that's your completion of the romance arc at that point.
Okay. Is this going to be a novel or a short story, or what format are you looking at?
Novel, probably on the short side. I tend to write shorter okay. rather than longer novels.
Okay. Just checking in the context of the scope of story that we can discuss. Excellent. Very cool. So we lead off with our customary disclaimer. Brian, would you be so kind?
Sure. anything and everything probably that either Dave, myself, or Lee have to say can and very likely is complete and total bullshit. So anything that we say, feel free to use it or to completely toss it away as asinine and amateurish at will.
Yes. We have no desire to impose any mandates or requirements upon you, good sir. This is purely for the hoping to shake something loose of the creative tree, okay?
Absolutely.
Awesome.
Excellent.
All right, we will defer now to our guest host for first impressions and any questions. Lee, what did you think of Kevin's story idea?
I liked the story idea. I thought there was some really interesting things going on there. I did wonder what happens with the father. He seems to go down to earth halfway through the story, and we don't hear about him anymore. And he sounds like he could be quite an interesting foil, perhaps add either some additional conflict with what's going on back up at the moon. You know, his daughter's obviously starting to become very successful in her own right, and her vaccine works, his doesn't. But we seem to lose track of what's going on with him. Do we know where his story goes?
I'm not entirely sure. I had a couple of different ideas for him, and it's really good you spotted that. I was thinking he could go back down there. His vaccine didn't work, and he dies. That seems very, very pat and far too simple. Another solution could be he goes down there. His virus works sort of, kind of, but not as well as he was hoping, or he's having trouble mass producing it. And hers is better in some way, and that sets up a father-daughter conflict as a possibility too.
I don't know that having him die is pat and oversimplified. If he's written as an important, as a major character, and if we grow to love this character, then having him die, can create quite a lot of emotional impact. And it's very rare. It's still very rare that we have important characters dying halfway through a story. I'm all for killing the buggers.
Maybe take that even a step further. What if he is on board the ship that's trying to get back?
Oh, yes.
You know?
Oh, very nice.
Either he gets sick, or it's, I can't do any more good down here. I need to get back to my research. I need to get back to what I'm doing. And the only ship that's going back is this sort of renegade ship that has, sick people on it, and it's his only chance to get back to his lab.
And gives his daughter the emotional reason to defy the orders of the base commander and go up onto the ship.
Exactly. Yeah.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah. If you go down that path, though, if the moon base commander refuses to let her father come back, how on earth is she going to reconcile with him afterwards? That would be a pretty hefty thing to get over.
But you can understand, him not wanting to allow, I mean, he's doing his duty. You get this wonderful conflict of I am responsible for the personnel on this base. Here is a group of infected, plague-ridden people threatening the integrity of that base. If that base leader character is drawn, and maybe part of the appeal, one of the things that appeals to the daughter in some strange way is his utter dedication to his people and to his responsibilities. Then that sets up a nice conflict for him, because he likes her, he cares for her, but he can't let her father on. She's has feelings for him, but she also loves her father, and you've got this massive tension knot being drawn until something, and we can always discuss exactly what it is, breaks that knot, and then the aftermath afterwards determines, how the relationships will unfold after that.
Yeah, and some of the most interesting romances for me tend to be the ones where that they belong together, but there's something major that is almost impossible for them to reconcile for them to be together. And if it's something this severe, then that just ratchets it up a notch and makes it more interesting for the readers to how are they going to overcome this? It makes your job a little harder.
No, it does make the writer's job a little harder.
Oh, yeah.
One way that could be resolved, of course, is that despite the fact that he is outwardly telling her not to do it because he knows that everybody is looking to him for guidance and all his superiors are keeping a very close eye on this situation, as they no doubt will, he forbids her from going, but he somehow sows the seeds that will allow her to escape his clutches and get up there. So despite the fact that he's towing the company line, at least verbally, she can discover later on that it's only because of something that he's done that she is able to break free from the moon base and get back up onto the ship. That, of course, does have the disadvantage that it does make her success somewhat dependent on him, which might be problematic in terms of the strength of her character.
Well, but early on, there could be something like part of her research requires her access to a section of the base that she doesn't have access to, and he bends the rules for her and gives her a security pass or security codes or whatever the paradigm is to get into this section. And conveniently enough, those self-same codes allow her to access the shuttle that lets her get off the base and to the ship that's drifting towards them.
Right.
So
very different tones, though, between him accidentally giving her the codes for the shuttle and him saying, I think what Lee was saying almost was, you know, like, don't you dare go in that there briar patch sort of thing, you know.
It's wink,
like,
wink.
Yes. Ah, gotcha. Wink, wink, right. Gotcha. Right. I gotcha. Yes.
Well, and maybe he just happens to not reprogram the codes on time or whatever it is that it can be by, you know, his design or by his, he does it on purpose, but maybe it's, you know, he's...
Sure. The codes cycle at precisely 6 p.m. and for 30 seconds, the doors will be unlocked. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that information will be useful to you, my dear. You know, that something along those lines. There's lots of ways to make that work.
If you ever work in bank security, I'm not banking with you.
Yeah. that's probably prudent on many, many levels. So, Kevin, I actually had a question. What is the purpose? I don't know if you've worked this out yet, but what is the purpose of the moon base before the meteor crashes and unleashes this virus? What's it doing up there anyway?
That's a very good question. I hadn't actually worked that out. Okay. I hadn't actually thought of anything in specific. I've done moon bases in stories before, and I hadn't thought of anything specific for this one, no.
Because it could be, you know, it could just be research. It could be, like you say, a fairly new moon base, but rarely is something like that just going to be up there to be up there. So there might be research going on. There might be, mining. They might be exploring, right. You know, tapping the moon for resources. And here's where my science fiction knowledge or lack thereof shines through. I don't know if there's anything on the moon worth mining.
If there's Helium 3.
And if it's a military outpost, then that's yet another reason for him to deny access to the ship.
Oh, yeah.
There you go.
Whether or not there's a virus problem on board.
And then you have the decision that has to be made. If they try to land, do we blow them up?
Yeah.
And then it you know, becomes even more severe, more conflict.
They have ordnance to actually back up that threat.
Right.
And it also depends on the political climate of Earth at this time, wherever you're setting this, Kevin. You know, if this is a United States moon base or is this an international moon base, is there war going on down on the planet that has to be wrestled with or contended with? You know, the tensions could be elevated greatly by the environment that this event occurs in.
Yeah, and if you have global outbreak and there's one nation that controls the moon base that is developing the vaccine, then you have massive political upheaval and suspicion between the different nations over, you know, are you holding it back? Is that why it's not working as well as you promised it would when, you know, your xenobiologist came back?
Yeah.
Or even you know, like, you guys have had your shot. You've screwed this up. Give us access.
Right. Right, yeah. Right.
Okay, and then the ship that comes can be from a totally different place.
Go ahead, Lee.
So I was going to say the action, obviously, the main thrust of the story happens between the ship and what's going on the moon base. But meanwhile, down on Earth, people are dying like flies. Is there an opportunity here then to look at the wider problem? Actually concentrate some of the story on some of the problems that are happening down on Earth because of that, or do you think that would be too much of a distraction?
I think you could. I think it depends on the how you wanted to focus the story. If I wanted to do this as a science fiction story with a romance undertone, then it's very easy to add a few more points of view, very easy to talk more about what's going on down there. If it's a romance story set in a science fiction setting, then it really should only have two points of view, mm-hmm. the female and male protag. So I think that's the question, is which way that story is going to go. And you know, what I'd probably do is begin writing it, play with a couple of extra viewpoints, and if they looked like they were working, keep them. If not, I'd probably yank them back out.
I'm going to give you a heads up right now, Kevin. Given the people on the Skype line right now, I know which way we prefer to go.
Oh, yeah. You guys want a big global epidemic thing with multiple points of view down on the surface and up in space and on the rocket ship. And
don't
and several maniacal villains.
This could definitely write that way.
Kevin, don't just listen to them. They have no romance in their souls. You can hear that.
That's right. Wow. That's right. We're Philistines down here. We want some stuff blowing up. So no, Lee's suggestion is spot on. And Brian, I think we need to expand our wheelhouse a little bit. Perhaps I've always wanted to use that word in a sentence, and perhaps embrace appropriate word the romance of this story.
Well, let's focus in on it then.
Don't forget, I brought up in the beginning, I've never written a romance before. In fact, I've never written a book that even did more than tangentially had romance between the characters in it. So this is something of an experiment, and that was, you know, it's part of a broadening of my own horizons as a writer to add more of a romantic element. How much? I'm not sure yet, but definitely to add it as a major theme of the book.
Well, Lee, seeing as how Brian and I are Philistines and have no romance in our souls. Perhaps you could guide us through what are the nuances of the romance story that could be exemplified within the story idea that Kevin's laid out here?
Oh, well done. I took my own pick for that one, didn't I?
Hoisted on your own petard, sir.
I'm going to pass on that one because I'm not somebody that reads or writes romance either. I just experience it in all its real life glory. I'd be interested to see what Kevin does with this. But certainly in terms of the actual structure of a romance novel, I don't know. Even though I'm kind of half writing something similar myself. I'm feeling my own way there. So, yes, I might be coming to you, Kevin, for advice on that side of things.
Well, and Lee, you're more than welcome to workshop a story on the Roundtable Podcast. We'll get a romance author on here and have them guide us all through these treacherous waters.
Excellent.
I don't know what you guys are talking about. My wife would beg to differ on the whole romance thing, but...
Oh, here it is. Here it is. He's throwing down now. Now, gentlemen, we're not going to tell this story, but I've heard how he proposed to his wife, and it's true.
Of
the four of us here, Brian probably has it going on. So, Brian,
but not
welcome
as a writer,
to your own
so I have
petard,
no idea
sir.
What I'm talking about at this point.
Well, let's move forward with our strengths. Let's put the romance on the shelf for now. Let it wink there like a jewel and remind us that it's there if the opportunity comes to invoke it. But let's continue talking about the story from, if nothing else, from a science fiction angle with romance overtone, shall we?
Excellent.
I have a question about the ship that lifts off with the infectants to get to the moon. And Kevin, I know that this is a rough story idea, so there's a couple of ways this could be running. Was the ship taken over? And you had mentioned in your story pitch that as it sits there in the standoff with the moon base, that the infectants take control of the shuttle. What led to its launching in the first place? And are ships so prevalent on Earth that another ship can be launched to the moon base so casually?
Good questions. Okay. I was picturing originally that it would be launched as an attempt for the a group of people realize that things are getting out of control, decide that they're going to go up, or either because they had heard a rumor that there was a vaccine on the moon, or because they figured they might be safer on the moon, but they're running to the moon.
Okay.
So they have decided to take off. Now, this could be one of those secondary countries we were talking about.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
The classic idea, of course, would be to have the governments of the Earth put forward the important people to go onto the ship, which is why our xenobiologist himself is on there, because he's somebody that needs to continue the research and on the moon base. But perhaps there are prominent politicians on there. Perhaps there are people who have been able to buy their way on, people who wouldn't ordinarily necessarily mix socially, but they are considered to be the people that need to be saved.
Oh, yes.
And one of them is covering up a cough.
Well, and now check this out. I got Lee, you just sparked something for me. What if, Kevin, what if during the course of the story, let's say that Earth is not in its most stable political circumstances. There are conflicts, there's mounting tensions, so on and so forth. With the meteor landing, if the meteor lands in the country that is the primary stakeholder and owner of the moon base, then that country would suffer the most devastating effects of the plague first. The other countries, seeing the country that holds the moon base and the planet's best hope, choose that moment before the virus weakens them completely to launch a coup and take over that country, effectively cutting off the moon base completely and making it this very, very tiny island and the last hope of humanity. Make it a military base so it has a little bit of firepower to defend itself with, but surely not enough to defend against the concerted world effort. So now, once again, the stakes have been ratcheted dramatically, and the moon base is literally all alone. They have no allies. And during the course of the story, the desperate attempt to foster allies, to try and ensure the work that the moon base has done is sustained, you know, because there's going to be somebody that wants to come in and just, you know, take over, and there's somebody else that wants to come in and support them and blah, blah, blah. But it creates a much more dynamic political and charged environment that could serve as a very powerful backdrop for whatever story, whether it's a romance or whatever that you want to tell. Does that make sense at all?
It does.
Too big?
I guess there's two things to think about here, that I would think about here. One would be, you need a nation then that is strong enough to be able to be the primary stakeholder in the moon base.
Sure.
But weak enough that the rest of the world can sort of step in and squash them within a couple days.
Well, once they've been plague infested and their population decimated by the meteorite and the plague that ensues, they're dramatically weakened.
Well, yes they're dramatically weakened, but I mean, yeah. You know, like if you're looking at, say, the U.S., we still have a military. The military would probably have their quarantine zone set up. The military would probably still be one of the more intact elements of the United States.
Sure.
But if you pick a smaller nation, maybe they only have a couple launch sites. All you really have to do to take over, to cut them off from the moon base, let's say it's the UK or maybe Australia.
Oh, yes.
No offense,
sorry.
If they only have one launch site, or maybe two launch sites that they're launching ships from, you really don't have to take over the whole country. You just have to take over the launch sites.
That's a good point.
And then hold them. Mm-hmm. And they've lost contact with the moon base at that point.
But it's unlikely, if it's one of the smaller nations, that they would be the primary shareholder stakeholder in something as important and as expensive as a moon base.
It would definitely require something to have happened in over the last 20 years that's different from what's happening right now. Mm. I wouldn't say it's impossible. It wasn't that long ago that we were looking at Australia setting up the first commercial spaceport. You know, if they say the U.S. said, no, we're not letting you set up a commercial spaceport, and those big investors decided to go to some other country instead because they were going to be allowed to do it there. Things could change exponentially very rapidly.
Yeah. Brian, what were you going to say?
I was going to say, especially if the larger countries shut down their space programs.
That'll never happen.
Well, yeah, I mean, well, and look at, and let's go ahead and take a page from contemporary news. I mean, we've got mega corporations who are literally taking over the space race.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you get Google and Amazon and James Cameron together in the same room and say, screw it, we're building a moon base.
Right.
Then
Virgin's on the verge of it, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah. They're
yeah. That's why they called Virgin.
Right.
Wow. A bunch of these companies are busy looking at doing that kind of thing. And all it would really take would be for the U.S. to say, oh, no, we don't think a commercial spaceport over U.S. airspace is a good idea.
Sure.
And they would say, okay. And they would go find some other country that would like those billions of dollars of investment.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. And then you've also got the corporate angle. So you can, you know, Kevin, how far in the future were you looking at on this?
I was thinking probably 20 years-ish. Okay. I mean, a lot can happen in 20 years. The first space shuttle launches were only 30 years ago. So, you know, a lot can happen in 20 years, maybe 30 years, but something in that vicinity.
And sure. What's the time scale of this story? How long is it from the virus hitting Earth to the standoff between the space station and the moon base?
Relatively short, less than a month.
Okay. Because this is where I have a problem with the science side of things. An alien virus hits Earth, I think it would probably take a little longer than 3 or 4 weeks for, you know, the most talented of scientists to come up with a viable vaccine. It's the thing that always bothered me with you know, TV science fiction, where the antidotes, the resolutions to these things come too easily. And yes, the first one didn't work, but you know, she's worked for, you know, she did some overtime over the weekend and came up with something that did work. 3-4 weeks, it works from a story satisfaction point of view, but it starts to fall apart when you start thinking about, you know, the logics of it. So maybe the time scale needs to be expanded significantly for that side of things to work. Of course, that's not the main That's not the main point of the story. I know it's a romance or certainly, you know, romance overtones, but I think if we're going to be having a science fiction story, the science needs to make sense.
Yeah,
that's not an awful idea. And one way to make that work, I was thinking about the science end of things too, and I was thinking about it from the opposite end of things, and that is that to have a plague work, it needs to be extremely virulent, and it needs to have a long incubation period during which the person is infectious.
Yeah.
So one thing I was thinking about, because it's an alien virus, it's not from the Earth, it's not geared to break into Earth-type cells. And our cells are a little different from whatever it used to eat, where we used to use to manufacture new viruses with. So it takes a little bit longer than an Earth virus might take before you get the full-on infection. I was thinking about actually expanding the period of incubation time a little bit more than most Earth viruses have. So that could actually work at that point. If you have a long incubation period, that explains how it got out in the first place. They thought that somebody was okay. It turns out the incubation period is like 2 weeks instead of a week or whatever. So these people were released from quarantine the quarantine was insufficient in some manner. The virus got out into the open. And it's only doubling every, you know, an infected person gets the disease, is infected, and begins showing symptoms 2 weeks later and is dead or cured a week or so after that. And they're infectious for almost all of that incubation period. Of course, so they're infecting other people during that time frame.
Yeah. And another way of, expanding the time frame without losing any of the drama necessarily is to not have it on the moon, have it on one of the planets in the solar system. So it takes longer to get there, which would therefore give the scientists longer to work on the problem itself.
Right.
Interstellar.
Boy, but that's
virus.
A long time travel.
Another possibility is maybe this isn't the first time that it's touched down. And maybe it's, you know, that this particular meteorite is the first one that the public is aware of, but they've had the virus for a little while already and have been working on it where they were able to contain it before, and now another one has hit down.
Ooh.
That is releasing into the public, so they now they have to speed up the process, but they already have a good year into it.
And that's why the moon base exists, to study and research the virus that they found on previous impacts that were so small and easily contained, but this one was much larger and actually broke out. And now, yeah, cool. And that's why the xenobiologist is brought in, because he's been one of the lead researchers. His daughter has a breakthrough on the moon base that the father was never able to achieve. There's a whole Oedipus thing there, or not Oedipus, but Freudian something, you know, killing your father to achieve your own maturity.
Would have the scientific community that is outside of the situation questioning how they could have come up with one so quickly. And now you've derailed that concept in the minds of your readers a little bit.
We already know about the virus. I like that. That's a good resolution.
That's interesting.
Also, of course, then that gives us the opportunity, or gives you the opportunity, because I'm not writing the bugger for you, gives you the opportunity to look at ramping up the tension somewhat once we don't have a name yet, once she's said, well, I've got a quarantine I think that works. And to perhaps, if they've already been working on it, they maybe have some infected people on the moon base already that they keep in quarantine and use as test subjects for these things. And if she tests out her virus, vaccine, and it doesn't work because it's a slightly different strain, because they're some of the original batch of people that contracted the virus, perhaps, and maybe they've had the metabolism slowed down so that they don't die, whatever. When she does escape the moon base to go across to the ship, we all think the vaccine doesn't work because it's not worked on these people, but she kind of thinks that it might it's a new version of the, it's a new strain.
Yeah.
Right.
So she's taking a huge leap of faith by literally infecting herself by going over to this ship test her vaccine.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which is another reason why he doesn't.
She does infect herself. Yeah. She deliberately infects herself in order to be banished to the ship.
Yeah.
So she doesn't escape to the ship. She infects herself in order that they will banish her there.
And there's a wonderful scene between her and the leader of the moon base where she's separated by a glass panel, and their hands meet on the glass. No, I'm sorry. Tell me I don't have romance in my blood. Come on.
Very pushing.
That's because you're not willing to go into the cheesy realm, but you know,
that's romance.
That's where you get your romance. You just have to treat it differently so that it, you know.
That's nice, Lee. I like that. I like that a lot.
I think romance in stories is wonderful. I think that you just have to have a good story too. So that's the key.
Kevin, I wanted to ask, did you ever see Contact, the movie Contact?
I have, yeah.
With Jodie Foster and Matthew McConaughey? Wonderful underpinning of romance underneath a very, very hard sci-fi story.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and that's what I was talking about with, you know, they can't reconcile that because he's a priest.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
No, so that wasn't an issue.
Issue?
Dude, they consummated in South America.
But it's Matthew McConaughey.
So you can't help but.
Right. Like if you cast anybody else, you couldn't buy it, you know?
But it's Matthew McConaughey, so we got to bed that boy.
So we give him a little bit of leeway there.
Okay. But Brian's point is well taken. You know, there's tension there. You've got the leader, and the same tension is built into this. The story that you've built, Kevin, as well. I think that taking that incremental romantic, you know, taking the longer view and building the romance slowly and having that be a counterpoint to whatever the other thematic arcs that you're building in the story would be a wonderful accent for this.
Right. Especially since she will think that he's, well, I don't know if she'll necessarily think this, but she could think that he's just standing in her way because of his job, when a lot of it is he's standing in her way because he knows what she's going to do and he doesn't want her to get hurt or to become infected. And then there's a whole other layer there.
Because his heart is already infected, of course.
Oh, dude. That. See? You got it. Okay. Okay, let me put something out here that's going to take Jodie Foster and Matthew McConaughey out of the movie version, and we're going to make it an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, just because I have to give this a try. Kevin, what if, here's the infamous what if the meteor, the virus on the meteor, A, is not accidental, and B, what if it's not a biological virus? Ultimately, in terms of how it affects our bodies, yes, it is. But what if this is a prelude to invasion or colonization? Maybe the alien race wasn't aware that there was sentient life on this planet, but they launched these meteors out to colonize and prepare sites for their exploration and eventual colonization. And the ejecta of the meteor is actually these nanites that analyze and consume quantities of resources in the area and start building a site, an alien base. And in order for the nanites to be effective, they need the contents, the core of the meteorite, which you very conveniently had them take up to the moon, which is now out of range of the nanites, so they're operating inconsequentially. Now, what this has done is totally blown this very nice, very pleasant arc of human events and turned it into something else. But is that something that at all appeals to you, do you think?
I think it would depend on how it was done. I think alien invasion stories can be done in a way that's very, very appealing and fun and interesting. And I think they can be done in a way that's trite and overwritten. And
absolutely. Absolutely. We would be going for the former, not the latter on that one.
Well, I mean, if you think about it, if she has a vaccine and she's gone to this ship that's flying up from Earth with the vaccine on board, let's say that the nanites are still going around. And she's, for whatever reason, maybe it is maybe it's not like robotic nanites. Maybe it's biological nanites, essentially. Sure. They have you know, these other things that they've done. And she has created a vaccine that will kill these things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And she's gone to the ship and she has a vaccine and the vaccine is effective. Well, they may not, you know, if anybody else is monitoring the Earth and watching how the terraforming process is going, they may not want her to have a vaccine. And so that ship could suddenly, you know, turn into an interesting way to get rid of her and her vaccine.
And escalate the story to a first contact story.
Right. They may decide that that's when they have to intervene. If they're watching from the side somewhere, they may decide that's where they have to intervene, and they intervene to go and try and take her out on the ship. There's your Arnold Schwarzenegger moment. Or Ripley. Ripley, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
There's no reason, of course, why this change of origin of this virus need affect the central romance side of things. But what it does is that when you discover that the book is selling by the million, it opens up the possibility for a sequel that goes in a slightly different direction.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah. Because you're right. They don't have to actually encounter the aliens if the daughter discovers that this isn't a biological virus, it's a biological terraforming agent, which then opens up the possibility of life beyond the stars. Then the question is, do we kill it? Are we killing a life form that's killing us? And you can raise that whole moral question and leave the whole alien thing, like Lee says, for book two. That's brilliant.
Yeah, we've sorted out this meteor. We've defeated this meteor. How wonderful. Final kiss and embrace before the camera is just about to pan away from them. It pans away from them, and we see a meteor storm heading to the Earth.
Dun, dun, dun. Dun, dun. That's, that's what we'd come up with. That's awesome. Yes.
Yep.
That's awesome.
And then somewhere in there, there's romance.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, and I think there is, introducing the alien angle of it ratchets up the sci-fi a little bit and invites Kevin to explore even more radical science fiction possibilities. God, we need to get Brian Lincoln back on here because he's a biomed guy. But we could explore that, and there's still plenty of room for the format of a romance to unfold in that environment.
Yeah,
that's awesome,
Kevin. You're no longer writing a short novel, though.
No.
No, this has moved on from that.
Yeah.
Kevin, I meant to ask right at the onset, was there anything very specifically that you were hoping to get out of this discussion that we haven't addressed yet?
No, not really. I came into this with a fresh idea that I really haven't played with all that much, specifically so we could kind of just toss around, throw a bunch of stuff against the wall and see what sticks.
I think we've done that, and some of it is gold. I think there's good stuff.
I think so too. There's some really good stuff in here.
Excellent. Excellent.
The nice thing about story ideas is there are you will never run out of them. There are always more.
Yeah. And by pursuing one, you spawn six others.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely. Gentlemen, I think we've done an excellent job of at least getting Kevin started down the road of a deeper exploration of the potential of this story. Lee, did you have any final words or suggestions or questions for Kevin regarding the story?
Final question was, obviously this is a very new thing. You've not started writing it yet. Had you any idea of what you were going to call it?
Oh, I usually don't name things until after I'm at least partway through the first draft. Oh, no, you have any ideas?
No. No, naming books is one of the hardest things. It really is. And you know, the number of times that we've had books come into to our imprint with a title that just wasn't quite right, it's so difficult to find the right title for something. So good luck with that.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of the
Romance on the Lunar Base of Pestilence.
Thank you, Brian. That's lovely.
I'll shut up again, sir.
ideas, names tend to come from themes, the thematic tone and flavor of the story. And Kevin, that's still evolving. We're not sure what the core story, what's the argument you're making for in this story? And that's still being decided. So no title yet. That works.
No title yet.
Brian, any last observations or suggestions for Master McLaughlin?
No, one of the things that struck me right at the beginning was not only, you know, the not having a title, but no names for any of the characters. And we went through this before on the phone call, and I remember I was going to ask that right at the beginning, do you have any names for the characters? Because sometimes that's an easier way for me to keep them in my mind. But no, I would say that, you know, this time through, it made perfect sense to me. I think it's got a really nice arc to it. All of the characters have something that they want, and, you know, just strengthen that. And then, I think you've got a really nice piece here. Really, really a lot of directions that you can go in, and I don't see any bad ones.
No, I agree. I think, you know, understanding the purpose of the moon base, understanding the political terrain and environment, on Earth and those details, those nuances, and understanding the nature of the virus. You know, if you decide to go with the alien angle, you know, that those specificities or those options can be geranimaled and realigned in a variety of ways, each one generating a different story. And I think if nothing else, I think we've highlighted some of those areas of potential pursuit that might eventually click into something that'll really, really grab you and send you off to the keyboard. I hope.
Definitely.
Awesome. Definitely.
Kevin, was there anything in particular you wanted to ask Lee, since this is a rare opportunity to tap the editor of Angry Robot Books?
Not so much ask, but just say, Lee, I just wanted to say, I love Angry Robots. I think it's a great company. Of the science fiction and fantasy publishers out there, you're probably on my short list of favorites. So keep up the good work over there. I think you guys do a really great job.
Well, thank you. And of course, the problem with podcasts is that you can't see how much I'm blushing right this moment. Seriously, it's always really nice to hear from people who like what we're doing, because that keeps us going. Thank you.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's not just the effect either. I mean, I talk to writers who write for a lot of different companies, and I've never heard a writer say a bad thing about Angry Robots. I've heard writers say bad things about just about every other science fiction fantasy publisher out there, but I've heard writers say a lot of good things about you guys and nothing bad. So,
yeah. Well, thank you.
The naysayers are executed. Excellent.
Yes.
Excellent.
There's a reason the robot is angry, you know. Okay.
And my own experience, Lee, was very much, I when I got on Twitter, I started following authors that were interesting, authors that other people were talking about. And it was a circuitous route, but I realized that all of the authors, you know, Adam Christopher, Lauren Bukes, so many others were all Angry Robot authors. And I'm going, we got to find out who these Angry Robots are. And you're part of the pantheon up there. It's outstanding.
Thank you.
So, and that said, Lee, thank you so much for taking time from the heaping plate of goodness that is your life, and helping us out, helping Kevin out, and joining Brian and I workshopping the story. It really means a lot to us.
Dave, Brian, yes. I had a great time, and thank you to Kevin, too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, friends, that wraps up another episode of the Roundtable Podcast. And Brian, I have one last quick announcement. By the time this rolls up, I'm going to be packing for Balticon, baby.
Oh, yeah.
So, dear friends, if you're going to be in the Baltimore, Maryland area, do check out Balticon. I'm just going as a gawking neophyte, having never attended one before, and I'm deeply looking forward to it. And if you're there, find me, shake my hand. I would love to meet you. That would just bring this whole podcast experience to a whole new level for me.
And he might, and that's a very big might, be carrying me around on an iPad.
Yes. we might discover just the true depths and lengths of Skype and that whole experience. That would that's be right. Awesome.
Oh, I thought you meant that your personality would have been digitally uploaded. Oh. That would have been awesome.
That would have been awesome and terrifying at the same time, because having Brian as our first AI, Lawnmower Man comes to mind.
That's right.
Yes. Grim and dark.
Well, there is no proof that I actually exist in physical form.
That's true. We have this picture. It could be anybody.
That's right. Oh,
my God. So, friends, thank you so much for tuning in. If you're enjoying what we're doing, please feel free to swing out to iTunes and drop a review, or at least rate us up there. We always appreciate that. If you have other ideas for Kevin's story, swing out to the website, roundtablepodcast.com. There's comments available in the post link. We'll, of course, be including links to Kevin's site, to the Angry Robot site, and any other references that were made throughout this particular episode. Drop us a line. You know, a lot of podcasters actually break out and actually do feedback episodes. And I think it would be just awesome if we got enough feedback from y'all, because I'm in Tennessee and I can say that, from y'all to whip up a great fan feedback episode. If there are any fans out there, we're still pretty young. But drop us a line at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. Brian, anything else before we wrap up, sir?
No, just to say thank you, Lee, for lending your expertise and unique point of view. It's good to have an editor on. It kind of switches things up a little bit. And
some credibility.
Yeah, absolutely. And Kevin, awesome story. So good luck with that, and let us know how that goes. And everyone else, go write.
Yes, indeed. Go write. Ideas are cheap. Sit down. Write a story about them. Bring it on the Roundtable Podcast. We'll turn it to gold for you. Thanks for tuning in, everybody, and check us in a couple of days. We'll have a whole new showcase episode up there for you, and a whole new author and a whole new vibe of awesomeness. Until then, take care of yourselves. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This episode is copyrighted 2012 by the Roundtable Podcast and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike license. That means don't sell it, but you can share it all you like. And you can even use pieces of it in your own derivative work, as long as you attribute us as the source and release the work under the same licensing terms. Theme music composed and performed by the talented Hepcats of Brotown. Gary Gold, David LaBruyere, Billy Nobel, and Matt O'Donnell. If you'd like to be a guest writer or guest host, or learn more about the Roundtable Podcast, please visit our website at www.roundtablepodcast.com or visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/roundtablepodcast. Our Twitter tag is @writerspodcast or just send us an email at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. Thanks for listening.